Our recent Tuesday evening talk and discussions have centered on the classic collections of images and poems, the 10 Oxfording pictures. And during these sessions, we've shared our experiences of taking our first tentative steps on the path, our doubts and discouragements along the way, and even some of the spiritual openings that we've had on our lifelong journey of awakening. It's been said that this journey has no goal or endpoint, and yet the language of Zen is filled with rich imagery. The mountaintop, the ox, the dragon, the 100-foot pole. All these iconic images hint at the possibility of deep, profound insights, which may appear only as brief glimpses into the world as it is, or possibly as prolonged, life-altering, even earth-shattering events, and a whole range of your experiences in between. Now, perhaps you may have at one time or another been cautioned not to see these rich milestone experiences as the be-all and end-all of our practice. There seems to be an unspoken rule that to talk about a Kensho or sudden awakening experience is a form of spiritual vanity to be avoided at all costs. Some may even regard reading or talking about other people's Kensho experiences as a kind of spiritual voyeurism. In my early days of practice, the harsh, severe forms that were meticulously adhered to contained an almost puritanical aspect that may have led to me supposing that talking about enlightenment was taboo. And in Philip Kaplow's book, The Three Pillars of Zen, he warns that many apparent enlightenment experiences are only makyo, that is, hallucinations or perceptual distortions that can be mistaken for seeing into our true nature. But I feel it's a shame to ignore these experiences where, even if only for a brief moment, we are transported outside the ordinary, where everything seems to come together as one, where we glimpse ourselves as not separate, not alone in a hostile universe, but as fullness, wholeness, and completeness. And these experiences can be so beautiful, so sublime, and so real, even hearing about them secondhand can be a great source of inspiration and faith. So with these caveats spoken, I want to relate some of these experiences, both ancient and contemporary, in hopes of giving some sense of a perspective on what happens and on what one may encounter. And I'll use as a backdrop for these stories a treatise written by Hongzhi Zhengzhui. Hongzhi lived from 1091 to 1157. He was a Chinese Buddhist monk who authored or compiled several influential Buddhist texts. His conception of silent illumination influenced the Chinese Cao Dong school. And as a side note, the Dao Yi, who was another master at that time called the Golden Age of Zen, was actually a contemporary of Hongzhi. And you'll remember Dao Yi, he's the author of the Vow for Awakening that we recite in our evening service. That's the one that begins, "Our only prayer is to be firm in our determination to give ourselves completely to the Buddha's way." So Dao Yi taught in the Lingji or Rinzai school of Chan, and Chan, of course, is the Chinese word for Zen. Our lineage here at the Zen Center of Denver, which is the Sanbo Kyodan, or sometimes called the Harada Yasutani school, contains elements of both Hongzhi's silent illumination Zen and Dao Yi's Rinzai Zen. Now, Dao Yi wrote many essays excoriating the practice of silent illumination Chan. For example, Dao Yi said, "They just sit in a ghostly cave on a dark mountain after their meals." They call this practice silent illumination, dying the great death, the state before the birth of one's parents. They sit there until calluses appear on their bottoms, yet they still do not dare to move. Harsh words. And interesting, though, Dao Yi and Hong Zhi themselves were said to have been contemporary great friends and practice partners. They were respectful of each other and shared a commonality that went beyond their sectarian boundaries. Hong Zhi's Saodong Silent Illumination School valued sitting in stillness, which, of course, we call shikantaza in the Japanese, as opposed to the Minji or Rinzai method of rigorous koan study. The Chinese Saodong school later evolved into the Soto Zen school as it developed in Japan. The great Dogen Kigen, who might rightly be called the father of Japanese Soto Zen, was a successor of Hong Zhi's. You'll remember that Dogen traveled from Japan to China to study Chan in 1217. After a long and arduous journey, Dogen ended up studying with Master Ru Jing, and Ru Jing had direct Dharma links to Hong Zhi and was abbot of the late Hong Zhi's temple, Jingdi, where Dogen stayed while he was in China. Well, that's our history lesson for today. Thanks for indulging me. I think it's always good to practice to trace our roots and acknowledge our ancestors and investigate where we come from. But now, lately, I'll tell you, I've had the privilege of studying a translation of the practice instructions of Hong Zhi with my teacher, Karen Ryuku Roshi. And it's been a truly delightful exploring the rich imagery and visionary metaphors in these practice instructions that come from the book Cultivating the Empty Field by Taigen Dan Leighton. Hong Zhi's practice instructions are written in the form of some 60-some essays, and I guess that's what you'd call these beautiful works of prose poetry. Reading these instructions, it is apparent that Hong Zhi is deeply familiar with the Enlightenment experience. And the main descriptors you'll find in nearly every one of his essays are, first, a vast spaciousness. Second, intense, brilliant light. And third, complete stillness or peace, wherein nothing moves. Many have experienced these attributes, from ancient mystics to ordinary, modern-day, everyday people. But few are able to describe these qualities of the Enlightenment experience, as does Hong Zhi. So listen, if you will, for the imagery of vast, spacious emptiness, brilliant, luminous light, and complete and utter stillness. And as a bonus, we even get a bit of ox herding imagery here. A plowman on the shining field. From the outset, patch-robe monks have this field that is a clean, spacious, broad plain. Gazing ahead beyond any precipitous barriers, within the field, they plow the clouds and sow the moon. They plow the clouds and sow the moon. With clear, bright understanding, vast and expansive, the true self accepts its function, whether emerging or disintegrating, whether in a position of receiving or releasing. Directly perform the same workings as earth and heaven, yin and yang, arising and dispersing along with the 10,000 forms. Lofty and majestic, where do they come from? Still, in solitude, where do they go? So we are told that the empty sky cannot encompass it. The great earth cannot uphold it. Subtly existing beyond shapes, perfectly empty beyond names, the merit of being and non-being is exhausted. The paths of the worldly and the sages are transcended. Then you have the opportunity to go home. Just then, what do you know? For 150,000 acres, you can see the cold, pure, shining snow. Observing this well, one can be a strong plowman. That's the end of the passage. Sublime poetry, isn't it? Incidentally, the term patchwork of monks referred to at the beginning of the passage is often encountered in Zen writings, and it's worth looking at. Roshio Enkyo O'Hara shares some background on this phrase in her book, Most Intimate, that some of us read and discussed at the Beginner's Book Club here. Enkyo Roshi writes, in the earliest times, followers of the Buddhist community wore robes that were sewn from the remnants of discarded cloth, thus integrating elements of all life, from baby diapers to charnel cloths. For Enkyo Roshi, the different pieces represent different parts of people's lives. The pieces of cloth had had meaning for those who gave them to her, from her friend who died of AIDS to the friend who succumbed from breast cancer. The abbreviated form of this robe is the Roksu, like this one I'm wearing. Mine is made from the cloth of a worn-out old zabuton from the Zen Center, and the zabuton is the mat that is under the cushion that we sit on. Okay, now let's look at some contemporary accounts of sudden enlightenment. In the last passage I read from Hong Zhu, in addition to light and spaciousness, there was conveyed a sense of oneness. Ajahn Shanti is a modern day teacher in the non-dual tradition. This passage comes from his book, Emptiness Dancing. He describes here his experience coming on the heels of some very intense early morning meditation sessions. He writes, sitting there on one of those particular mornings, two things happened, one after another, and they seemed very paradoxical. The first one was a spontaneous seeing that everything was one. For me, that manifested as hearing a bird call, a chirp in the front yard, and from somewhere inside me, the question arose, what is it that hears that sound? I never asked this question before. I suddenly realized I was as much the sound in the bird as the one hearing the bird, that the hearing and sound and bird were all manifestations of one thing. I cannot say what that one thing is, except to say one thing. I opened my eyes and I found the same thing was happening in the room. The wall and the one seeing the wall were the same thing. I thought that was very strange, and I realized that the one thinking this was another manifestation of that. I got up and began to move around the house looking for something that wasn't part of the one. But everything was a reflection of that one. Everything was the divine. I wandered into the living room. In the middle of a step, consciousness or awareness suddenly left everything, whether it was a physical thing or body thing or a world thing. All in the step of a foot, everything disappeared. End of quote. So there is that deep sense of non-separation. The next contemporary account points out the presence of light. Stories of the ancient mystics include seeing intense light, notably St. Paul, who had a profound conversion and was blinded by divine light on the road to Damascus. Eckhart Tolle the now quite famous contemporary spiritual teacher, wrote the following beautiful account of his spiritual awakening. His awakening experience purportedly came prior to formal spiritual training and out of a deep sense of unease and depression, which are often a prelude to a profound breakthrough. And note like Adyashanti's account, the presence of a bird plays prominently here. I was awakened by the chirping of a bird outside the window. I had never heard such a sound before. The first light of dawn was filtering through the curtains. Without any thought, I felt, I knew that there is infinitely more to light than we realize. That soft luminosity filtering through the curtains was love itself. Tears came to my eyes. I got up and walked around the room. I recognized the room, and yet I knew that I had never truly seen it before. Everything was fresh and pristine, as if it had just come into existence. I picked up things, a pencil, an empty bottle, marveling at the beauty and aliveness of it all. End of quote. And last, an account by another ordinary person, a carpenter by trade, who is not actively involved in any religious practice. David Karse was not a spiritual seeker. Yet, while trekking through the jungles of Ecuador, as he was staring from a thatched longhouse into the rainforest, David experienced an intense and graphic fear that culminated in a resignation toward the certainty of death. Again, here's the state of being in some state of extremity prior to the experience. This account illustrates the aspect of complete stillness that often accompanies deep insight experiences. Still later that night in the jungle, toward morning, lying there, there was a point when all the experiencing stopped. The thinking and the feeling and the processing that had been happening all completely ceased. I was not aware of it, quote, at the time, because there was no thought and no awareness of time or indeed of anything. Only in hindsight is there a looking back and realizing that there was a, quote, period of time, out of time, when there was no thought, no experience, no thing, nothing. It may have been hours, it may have been an instant, it was not of time. Only in retrospect can it be called a place or a time of stillness or emptiness, because when it was occurring, there was no time and no place and no sense of awareness of anything happening. I was not asleep. It was a condition of complete stillness and completely alert awareness. But there was nothing there to be aware of. No sense even of self to be self-aware. It could be called a completely empty stillness and awareness. I have no idea how long this lasted. And that's the end of the quote. Well, I hope you've gleaned something from these accounts. There's an old saying in Zen, a picture of food does not satisfy hunger. So, of course, no account by somebody else is a substitute for your own true experience. But allow me to end by sharing my account of an early insight experience. And I offer it only so that you might be inspired to seek out and find for yourself whatever, in whatever form it takes and however long it takes. My early days of Zen practice at the Denver Zen Center were extremely difficult physically, mentally, and emotionally. Over 30 years ago, this place that we call home encouraged an austere, strict, almost a samurai style of do or die striving for the much sought for and highly touted kensho or enlightenment experience. After practicing and sitting some zazenkai, the all-day sittings, and a weekend sesshin or two, I trepidatiously entered a seven-day sesshin. Gripped from the start by leg pain from forcing myself to sit in a half lotus posture, tortured by strain induced by tension in my neck and shoulders, I was self-consciously afraid of what others thought of me. Oh, I'm sweating profusely. Do I smell bad? Will I mess up at the formal oryoki meals? Will my teacher reject my answer in Dokusan? In short, I was a total mess. Desperate to crash through into some imagined exalted state, one night I stayed up past the formal block of sitting of evening zazen and sat alone in the sweltering heat of the converted garage zendo that was at the old Columbine Street. At some point around midnight, I went out into the coolness of the garden and sat on a bench beside the meditation path. I was gazing at the vinca vines covering the ground with wild strawberries peeking out from underneath. Suddenly, everything within my field of vision became luminous and large. The boundary between my body and the sounds, sights, and sensations of the cool summer night disappeared. This sense of luminosity and non-separation lasted for quite some time. And afterwards, I picked a few wild strawberries and put them on a little plate that I left for my teacher in the Doksan room. Now, my wife, who is my first and best teacher, has suggested that perhaps this and other sesshin experiences from that time were brought about by hunger and lack of sleep, coupled with extreme physical and mental stress. Perhaps she's right. Maybe it was just makyo. It's been postulated by some great philosophers that all of our subjective experiences are false, or at least illusory or inaccurate. An experience of true no-self, which is called in Sanskrit anuttara samyak sambodhi, actually implies that there is no one there to report on the experience. But having any kind of breakthrough experience, whether small or large, may offer hope and perhaps provide the courage and strength to continue on the path. So without getting too attached to them on the one hand, or discounting them all completely on the other, I urge you to cherish these little jewels for what they are, proof of your true and undivided nature. So if you have questions or you want to explore this further, feel free to stay after the great vows and announcements, and you know, we could possibly discuss that some more or celebrate our year together that we survived the pandemic. And Joel, if you want, you could make me the host and I'll stick around. But rather than discussion, the best way to verify a kensho or any other practice-related state or experience is to go to Doksan and consult your teacher. And please take advantage of this wonderful opportunity we have here at the Zen Center. In Buddhism, we vow to save the many beings, and you don't need, nor should you, collect enlightenment experiences like notches on a belt. We are from the very beginning, whole and complete. Making coffee and folding laundry, hugging your child or changing a flat tire are the acts of a supremely enlightened bodhisattva. Have the faith that you can wake up at any moment during any activity. Continue to wake up in each and every moment, and then, together with all beings, as one enlightened body, we realize the way.